You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, November 21st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District in New York City. Today on the program, from 350.org, the great Bill McKibben. Also on the program, from the other 99, the Ustream that has become the premier Ustream of for people who want to follow Occupy Wall Street in New York City. We'll be talking to at least one of the hosts, Tim Pool. That and more on the program today. Egypt, more violence as protesters demanding that the military give up power. The super committee, it looks like it's dead. We will get into that more, particularly tomorrow. But for now, it looks like it's dead. No deal better than a bad deal. Updates from Occupy Wall Street around the country. Larry Summers weighs in about income inequality. And just more evidence of how much impact Occupy Wall Street has already had. And we're now just going into Occupy Wall Street is just now basically gone. It's gone from a toddler into whatever the age is after being a toddler. And I anticipate Occupy Wall Street growing up to live a long and healthy life. I don't know if you saw, we had the day off on Friday in the wake of the marathon 12-hour show. I want to thank all of you for your support, for calling in. I want to tell any callers hanging on the line, we'll get to you later in the program. We've got a couple of interviews first to do. But we got a lot of support, got a bunch of new members, as many as I would like. No, that can never, ever, ever happen. We can never get as many members as I would like. And we are not quite at how many members we need. Appreciate all the listeners. We have thousands of people have listened to the first two installments of the podcast. Just a little bit of house cleaning. Members will receive the remaining approximately nine-ish hours on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We'll be releasing approximately three-hour podcasts those days of the show. And you non-members, yeah, maybe you'll get 90 minutes over the course of those 3 days. So as you're driving home for Thanksgiving, do you want a three-hour show, a six-hour show, or a tiny show? It's up to you. Briefly, University of California, you've probably seen the images of two policemen pepper spraying a bunch of threatening college kids who were threatening these cops by sitting cross-legged and holding hands. Just a horrible, horrible, horrible video. And we have it posted on our site, or at the very least a link. And now the president of the University of California System said he was appalled at the images of protesters being doused with pepper spray, plans an assessment of law enforcement procedures on all 10 campuses. And two of those police officers and the police chief have been placed on administrative leave. You know where they should be spending that administrative leave? In prison. In prison. It was just so ruthless. And these college students couldn't have been less threatening. I mean, it just couldn't have been a less threatening situation. And I'll tell you what, if those cops felt threatened in that situation, there you need a whole new police force. Because if they felt threatened in that situation, there is no situation where they couldn't feel threatened. The most disproportionate response I think one could imagine. Pepper spraying students who are simply sitting on the ground.
Not just pepper spraying them, crop dusting them. It was just over and over again, back and forth.
And the casualness in which the police officer did it, I think, is a perfect testament to just how little threat he felt. Stunning. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to go and come back with an interview I did this morning with Bill McKibben. Coming up in the show, Chris Hayes breaks some news with a memo, which again is indicative of just the amazing achievement by Occupy Wall Street to change the political atmosphere. I am also not unconvinced that were it not for Occupy Wall Street, the Democrats on the super committee would have completely sold out. I think the evidence is overwhelming. First, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Bill McKibben. And then later in the program, the Occupy Wall Street, the other 99 videographers, live broadcasters, call them what you will. We'll ask them what they call themselves. We'll be right back after this.
Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same.
Look the same. Look the same.
There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
We are back. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to this program Bill McKibben. He is the founder of 350.org. Welcome back to the program, Bill.
Sam, always a great pleasure to get to be with you.
Speaking to you over the past several months, I guess almost this past year, has been sort of a touchstone. I mean, we spoke, we first spoke this year right after Tim DeChristopher was convicted of essentially interfering in an auction to auction off our land, the government land for oil drillers. It turned out that he didn't really interrupt the auction because it wasn't going anywhere anyways, but he was still convicted. And at that time, we had talked about the chance for direct action by environmentalists. And you predicted at that time that we would see more of this. And in fact, you were one of the organizers behind a series of protests and arrests that took place in late August into September about the Keystone Pipeline. Just refresh our memory. What is the Keystone Pipeline?
Sure, a proposed pipeline that would run from the tar sands of northern Alberta down to the Gulf of Mexico. And the reason that it's, you know, beyond the danger of spills and beyond the damage that's been done up in Alberta, the other reason that it produced what was the largest civil disobedience action in the U.S. in about 35 years was that there's so much carbon up there in those tar sands that we've got to do whatever we can, including blocking this pipeline, to try and slow its exploitation. Otherwise, if we tap heavily into it, as Jim Hansen at NASA put it, it's essentially game over for the climate.
And now this is a pipeline that was to run from Alberta, Canada, down through the United States, through multiple states. And there were sort of two issues. In addition, there's the macro issue of what it would mean for climate change. And I guess the micro issue in that Keystone 1, which is a different pipeline, had a leak per month, I think, from when it was built. And the havoc it can wreak locally. And this ended up being a pretty big part of the story because I noticed first that President Obama, I think it was on Nebraska radio, had said that he was going to make this decision as opposed to the State Department.
That's right. We worked hard to get the president to take the responsibility that was his, and then we were very gratified when he did the right thing, and or at least part of it, and sent it back. For much more review, including a review not only of its impacts in places like Nebraska if it spilled, but also its impacts on the climate. So, you know, no sweeping victory. There are no sweeping victories in environmental stuff, but definitely a demonstration that we can stand up to corporate power from time to time, and if we do it in kind of a loud way, occasionally prevail. We were very much sort of a piece with the Occupy movement as it unfolded in the fall, and they were a big part of this too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was fascinating from my vantage point to follow what was happening here because you did have a direct action where I think about 1,500 people were arrested over the course of these 2 weeks in late summer, early fall, and at the White House. And then simultaneously, we saw reports that there was lobbyists for TransCanada, Trans Arcadia, I think it is, that that owned the pipeline was being hired by the State Department. So there was sort of attacks on this from, it seems to me, from all fronts, both an outside-in game and to a certain extent an inside-out game.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's how when you've got something this big and this wired and this profitable that you have to kind of go after it. And people found all sorts of problems with this pipeline once we got going. And there was amazing work from all kinds of different environmental groups, but also from indigenous groups, from ranchers and farmers. It was the truly kind of broad coalition that we try to aim for among progressives and don't achieve as often as we should.
And there was, there was interesting sort of fault lines in this debate because we had a couple of unions who came out in favor of it because ostensibly there was supposedly going to be thousands upon thousands of jobs created. But the evidence for that job creation was pretty shaky, wasn't it?
Yes, on closer scrutiny, it turned out that there probably weren't. I mean, there are obviously some jobs digging the pipeline, but the one analysis not paid for by TransCanada, in fact, conducted by the labor movement, showed that there would be a loss of as many jobs as a result of the pipeline raising gas prices across the Midwest. In the end, labor split down the middle. The building trades were in favor of it, and several big unions, transport workers, Amalgamated Transit, Domestic Workers Union, all came out against it.
And so the Obama administration has sort of sent the whole proposal back into the process to be evaluated again, and I apparently on different on a sort of a different track, and maybe looking for different things than in the initial review of this proposal. What do you think the chances are that it survives? I mean, there's obviously like supposedly a big expense for TransCanada to go through another review process.
Yes, well, it's definitely going to cost them some money. They've got a lot of rusting pipe now sitting out across the Midwest that they're planning on hooking up this winter. Look, after the election, President Obama could do the wrong thing and approve this. After the election, President Obama could do the right thing and block this and then approve four more plans for other pipelines. After the election, President Romney could approve 161 pipelines running, you know, every possible place the Koch brothers asked for one. There's no guarantee of any kind of permanent victory here. We have called a lot of attention to the tar sands. We've got great work going with our Canadian brothers and sisters who are trying to block two proposed routes west to British Columbia, and they're doing an amazing job up there. I was just in Vancouver. But this is, you know, I mean, even if we succeeded in blocking every ounce of tar sands oil, we still haven't stalled climate change or even come close. Even without the tar sands, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere is just going up and up and up. So we've, we've won a small victory, and maybe the most important part of that victory is pointing the way forward in kind of tactical terms, showing us what we need to be doing.
Yeah, that aspect of it fascinates me because I think while the Occupy protests and occupations were sort of in the works when your action took place out in front of the White House, I'm convinced that when people see other people essentially getting themselves arrested, involving in some act of civil disobedience, it adds an element, something goes into the ether, which makes that hurdle that much lower. It emboldens people. It sends a message that there are some things that are that need to be sacrificed. There are some risks that people need to take, and they can be effective. Give me a sense of what Occupy Wall Street did for its very existence, and maybe on both sort of like a more sort of transcendent level, but also on a real on the ground level.
So on the ground, they were tremendous allies, people helping in all kinds of ways. 2 weeks ago, when we were circling the White House, five deep in people, Occupy Portland in Portland, Oregon, was circling the federal building. I think I've been to seven Occupy encampments so far, and found enormous support in all of them. And it's because we've said from the beginning exactly what people at Occupy are saying. This kind of thing, like Keystone, is a perfect example of why corporate dominance of our politics is an unsound idea. And in this case, it's not just because it makes our economy more unequal, it's because it makes our atmosphere more crowded with carbon. It literally heats the planet. When I went to Occupy Wall Street, I said, thank you very much. It's time we returned the favor. Wall Street's been occupying the atmosphere for a quarter century and blocking any kind of progress on climate. So it's about time that we did the same.
I mean, it's interesting because I think too there's a philosophical similarity in the sense that the climate is all of ours, and we see that same dynamic where externalities, essentially, where we see these corporations sort of lay off the externalities, the other costs that are involved in what they're doing that we don't see directly on their books, i.e., failure of crops in certain parts of the world, the inability to breathe by our children, the medical expenses, the future essentially of our planet. All of these costs are borne by everybody, but the profits are for a very specific few. And it seems to me that's very consistent with this sort of broader notion that the economy is for all of us and not just for the profit
absolutely.
Of a few.
Absolutely. I mean, damn right. The oil companies have figured out how to, in essence, privatize the atmosphere. Their deal is a sweetheart deal by any means. They get to dump their main waste product, carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere for free. They get to use the atmosphere as an open sewer for free. And, of course, that would be a deal any business would like. I mean, if every restaurant in New York just at the end of the day shoveled all their garbage out into a pile in the middle of the street and left it there, it would save them money. Their profits would go up. It would also make New York unlivable within a matter of days. That's more or less what's going on in our planet right now.
And so what is next for the environment? What is there a obviously the big issue in our environment is global warming, and we're seeing more reports almost every month that the rate of increase in the change in the global temperature is increasing, even beyond what people have been predicting. But what is next in terms of specific measures that the environmental movement is going to attempt to deal with as we try and return to some, broader policy that is sane?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the next few months, the Obama administration will put out rules on greenhouse gases and on mercury pollution and that kind of thing, and these will be important. There'll also be a likely to disappoint big global climate meeting in Durban, South Africa, at the middle of December. We're not making huge progress anywhere, it must be said. And that's because of the power of the fossil fuel industry, really enshrined in Citizens United, to bully everybody into protecting that sweetheart deal I described. You'll know we're making real progress if and when we're able to attach a significant price to carbon. Whether we can do it while corporations remain persons, you know, and have that kind of power, I just don't know.
You know, I saw a report. I don't have it in front of me, but I saw a report over the past couple of weeks that showed that the number one bastion, if you will, of global climate change denialism is amongst white males. Why do you think that is?
I got to say, I've got no idea. I'm one myself, and so I don't know. I mean, I suppose you could say they're the people who've ended up with the most privilege in our society, which in turn is the most privileged society on Earth in certain ways, and hence they're most resistant to change. That's the best I could do. I doubt there's some, you know, skin tone related thing that goes with it, but I think it probably has to do with that level of privilege.
And is at the end of the day, when you contemplate, you know, what has to change in a broader sense. Obviously, we need to have policies, and like you said, we need to associate a cost with carbon so that it can be calculated into ideas of what constitutes profit, what constitutes cost, and who bears these costs. But when you look at sort of strategizing long term, is it necessary to have a full acceptance of the implications of climate change and a full acceptance? I mean, because climate change denialism seems to be a party plank.
I'm afraid it is necessary, and that's one of the things that makes it hard. It's necessary because the scale of change required is, if we're going to deal with the biggest problem we've ever faced, is large, and we're not going to be able to do it just solely by talking about green jobs or whatever it is. But sooner or later, we're going to come to grips with the fact that we're in real trouble and need to make real change. Now, you know, Mother Nature is going to continue to provide teachable moments to help remind us of that, unfortunately. But I think that that's, you know, what we're going to have to do, and that means breaking the power of the fossil fuel industry to set the political agenda. Not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, we can see the attacks, whether it's people harping on the idea of Solyndra or government subsidies, but only those subsidies, of course, that would in any way help us get to a more, climate-friendly way of powering our lives. And to a certain extent, we also need to, as a society, just simply change the way that we perceive our economy and our society operates.
Yeah, look, this is the biggest thing that's ever happened. As the temperature warms, last year was the warmest year for which we have records. We see epic amounts of damage as the UN pointed out this week, the IPCC, all this extreme weather flows from the fact that we've poured so much carbon into the atmosphere. If we can't reverse it, we're going to be in much, much, much worse trouble. And so it's a kind of epical challenge. At 350.org, we'll keep working on it. We've built a big global grassroots movement. We're beginning with things like Keystone to show that that can be used for serious action. But clearly, we're not strong enough yet to take down the fossil fuel industry.
And I think you've also shown through this Keystone action perhaps a game plan for progressives, liberals, environmentalists. I mean, people who are looking to the Obama administration to make change. I think there is at the very least, one of the most effective game plans we've seen in terms of how to move the Obama administration. And some of that involves intense confrontation.
Yeah, the one thing we did the whole time was never attack the president. We always said we just wanted him to do what he said he was going to do in 2008. When we ringed the White House, it was all banners with quotes from him in 2008. We said we needed that Obama back. And at least on this issue, at least for a little while, we got him, and that was a good thing.
Bill McKimmon from 350.org, thanks so much for joining us. Always
Thank
a pleasure.
You, brother.
It's Sam Seder launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
We are back. That was Bill McKibben from 350.org. One quick story. As reported by Chris Hayes on Up With Chris this weekend, I guess they broke this story. A prominent Washington lobby firm with, I guess, obviously has links to the financial industry because they're pitching them. They created a document to pitch their services to the American Bankers Association. I don't think these pitches are unsolicited, folks. That's just not the way it works. You or I can't just send, well, I suppose we could just send it, unsolicited pitches to these organizations, unless we've done work with them before, unless we have some type of reputation with them, we work with them. It is from the Clark Little Geldolg Cranford, and it's sent to the American Bankers Association. They want $850,000. Not bad work if you can get it. In fact, I would have done this probably for closer to like $775. To do Oppo research on Occupy Wall Street in order to construct negative narratives. I'll tell you something. Those guys at Breitbart, Stranahan, if I was him, I'd be very pissed. He's going out there and trying to construct false negative narratives. He's not getting paid a dime. Well, maybe a little bit, but not hundreds of thousands of dollars. Meanwhile, it asserts that Democratic victories in 2012 would be detrimental for Wall Street and targets specific races in which it says the Wall Street would benefit by electing Republicans instead. This is a quote. If Democrats embrace Occupy Wall Street, this would mean more than just short-term political discomfort for Wall Street. It has the potential to have very long-lasting political policy and financial impacts on the companies in the center of the bullseye. But their biggest concern is that Republicans will no longer defend Wall Street. Two of the authors worked directly in John Bonaire's office as staffers before moving on to K Street. And, of course, ABA said, well, we received the proposal, and we chose not to act on it in any way now. It also suggests that one concern is that Occupy Wall Street may team up with elements of the Tea Party. Well-known Wall Street companies stand at the nexus of where Occupy Wall Street protesters and Tea Party overlap on angered populism. This combination has the potential to be explosive later in the year when media reports cover the next round of bonuses and contrast it with stories of millions of Americans making do with less this holiday season. So just one more example of how Occupy Wall Street has really shook the ground beneath the apologists on the right. Opening up and talk about creating jobs. The very existence of Occupy Wall Street made at least these lobbyists think they were going to make $850,000. And you got to know, folks, the one thing that is the case is that these type of lobbyists, they follow the herd. If there's one of these documents, there's tens of these documents. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to, at the very least, Tim Pool of The Other 99. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program one of the guys involved in my favorite Occupy Wall Street feed. I'm talking about The Other 99, Tim Pool. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Now, give us a little background. When did you... Did you start doing this on your own? How many of there are you, and when did you start?
Well, we started with four of us. There's Henry James Ferry, Will McLeod, Jesse LaGreca, who most of you probably know, and then me, Tim Pool. And we've been doing this since the very beginning of Occupy Wall Street. It's sort of been a snowball rolling down a hill. You know, as time goes on, we build more momentum, and we saw a really big spike in that this past week.
Right. And, you know, my favorite moment, I think, in watching your coverage was the night that people marched in front of City Hall and then began to move up Broadway to Union Square. And at one point, the protesters grabbed the kettling net and began to run through the street to it. And I still, we of course, played the clip at the time, but it still resonates in my head. This night belongs to Occupy Wall Street. Give me a sense of what's been the most sort of dramatic moments for you as you've been covering this.
There's obviously that night with the occupiers taking the orange kettling that really just left me in awe, and that's, you heard me yell, "Tonight belongs to Occupy Wall Street," and they started to hold their net over their head and chanted, "Whose net? Our net." There was one of the other most intense events for me was when the vandals who were draining the tires on the NYPD vehicles, you know, sort of rushed at me, trying to get me to turn the camera off, and, you know, they're swinging at me. One guy grabbed me, and then I think another really just awe-inspiring moment is when the freight truck was trying to leave the park with all of the possessions, and there was, you know, about 50 to 75 of the protesters linked arms, and they chanted, "We are the 99%, and the police were pushing on the crowd with the barricades trying to break them apart, and they couldn't do it, and the freight truck actually had to back up and retreat. It was, you know, everyone cheered in victory.
Tell me, you know, what is your agenda? I mean, how do you perceive yourself? Are you a reporter? Are you an activist? Is there something in between? I mean, what you're doing is a relatively new phenomena in media, to be live streaming like this with so few bars to entry. How do you perceive yourself?
I perceive myself as an activist. I've always perceived myself as an activist. I'm doing this for transparency, which I feel is really the most important thing when it comes to, you know, policy and historical events. Too often, or actually it's a fact, that history is written by the winners. And on Tuesday and Thursday, that just wasn't true. History was just written on the live broadcast through my point of view.
And, I think that's a very interesting point, because I think this, Occupy Wall Street, in many respects, the documentation that you do and the media that the movement itself puts out is redefining how it can both the process and the story simultaneously. I mean, it's interesting to me because, you know, when Occupy Wall Street first started, it got very little media coverage, but managed to grow despite the fact that it wasn't getting the traditional media coverage because they were putting it out themselves. When did you start, what were your hopes?
I guess I really didn't have any. We started working on a way to do a live broadcast, and I found the Ustream mobile app, and I thought, hey, that's really easy to do. I can just point my cell phone. And the original intention was we were going to have a bit of political theater where Henry would do his conversation with the 1%. But, you know, we saw an arrest happen, and action started happening. And so it quickly changed to spontaneous on-the-ground reporting using a live broadcast that people could just, you know, see what's happening and decide for themselves.
And did you, is that what you're using? Only an iPhone? Is that it?
Well, I'm actually using a Galaxy S2. But yeah, that's about it.
What's a Galaxy X2?
It's a Galaxy S. It's a Droid phone. A Sprint Unlimited.
So you shoot all of it through your phone?
Yeah, I have the Sprint Galaxy S2 with unlimited data, uh-huh. And it's hooked up to an XPAL 18,000 milliamp battery.
Wow. Interesting. I had no idea. I, for some reason, I presumed you guys had a camera rig, but just because the quality is that good.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm doing a commercial here, but it's got a 8-megapixel 1080p high-def camera in the back of it. And
just for full disclosure's sake, you're not a paid spokesman, correct?
No, I am absolutely not.
All right. Well, sorry. Now, tell me also how this evolved with you and Henry, because when I first started watching it, Henry seemed to be sort of the correspondent. And then at one point, you guys had multiple cameras going, the other 99 and the other 99 too. So how does that work out? Is it just a question of who's available that day, who's able to get down there? What are the inner workings?
When it first started, the sort of dynamic we had was that I was just handling the technology and Henry was actually giving the reports. But, you know, as I'm the one who set it up and knew how to make it work, with this action happening, you know, especially the Oakland Solidarity March that we were just talking about, it was hard for us to stay together because you have just, you know, we had 2,000 people in the street. I'm running full speed to try and film it, and Henry gets lost in the crowd. And I was sort of, you know, put in the spot to take over the narration. And, just with Tuesday, with the eviction, Henry and I were just not, we are two different meetings. I was at the Spokes Council to see what that was going on. Spokes Council is an organizational system for Occupy Wall Street. So when the eviction started, I was by myself, and I had to do the reporting on my own. And so with the success from that, and everyone sort of clamored to keep the stream going, Henry decided to use a second channel for the other 99. And so we actually ended up with with multi-view from, you know, on the ground. You can actually switch back and forth when you're on our channel.
And you, your feed, I believe it was on the, certainly last Thursday, was picked up by multiple sort of mainstream media outlets, corporate media outlets.
Yeah, Tuesday as well. We were on Al Jazeera, Time.com. I also heard that we were on Reuters. It's a huge list that, you know, everybody was, Huffington Post is one. They were just, we were the primary source at that point.
And so what are you doing now? I mean, how do you support yourself doing this? It seems to me that you do it almost every day. I mean, how do you support yourself doing this?
Well, initially I was living off of my savings, but people had made contributions to the other 99 since day one. And that, you know, provided us with the resources to be on the ground providing this coverage. And with the recent exposure we got since the eviction to the, sort of reclamation of the park, we've actually, our donations have increased significantly.
And so what's next for you guys? Do you continue to do this coverage? Are you are you helping? You know, I've watched other streams, frankly, and I just wish that you guys had trained them, because I think, you know, what you both do quite well, from my experience, at least viewing, is you are fairly measured in your coverage. You're fairly careful to clarify when you've witnessed something or when you are, sourcing the information you get, so that we know the LRAD sticks out in my mind, that you had multiple sources telling you that they had seen it, and you made it clear that that was the case. And I wonder if you guys have been in touch with other streamers around the country to help advise them on how to go about approaching it. Has there been any conversations like that, or is it just you're operating on your own?
Well, we don't coordinate with other teams, but I have given a lot of technical advice as to how I do the broadcast. Most of the other teams use the live stream program. We use Ustream, and Ustream.tv actually has the mobile app where you broadcast right from your phone. Mm-hmm. And live stream, actually, you'll see these teams walking around with laptops and webcams with external batteries and hotspots. So they're, they don't have the versatility. Now, as for sort of the narration, the reporting, I spoke with Vlad from Global Rev, and he said, what you guys do is exactly what everyone should do. Giving your report a narration of what's happening so that people can get a better understanding of it. That's, yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And we can expect more from you guys in the future, yes?
Yeah, I plan on being in Oakland on December 12th, where they've actually planned to shut down all of the ports. So that's, my real hope.
December 12th in Oakland, and we'll keep an eye. The website is, the Ustream is ustream.tv/the other 99. And what's your website?
WeAreTheOther99.com.
WeAreTheOther99.com. Tim Poole, thanks so much for spending some time with us. Really appreciate your work, and you're doing a great job, and keep it up.
All right, thanks. Take care.
Okay. All right, folks. That's all right. This is the way we're going to end the show today. It's not La Poupe. It's okay. You want to dip back down? All right, folks. Remember, you can become a member at Majority FM. You can support this show by buying coffee. Fair trade coffee. It makes a great gift. JustCoffee.coop. You get a 10% discount, Majority, in the coupon code box. We're getting T-shirts. We're trying to figure out a place to get mugs as well. If you send suggestions, we need it to there to be a fulfillment process. Unless, I guess, somebody, I don't know if would do that. Have you mugs shipped to you and you in charge of, I don't know if that's. And of course, if you're going to buy junk on Amazon, buy it through our link. That way you kick back some of that corporate money back into our coffers. Tomorrow on the program, not sure whom. You'll have to stick around to find out. We're going to go to the better half of the program now. I know that we've got some libertarians on the phone. And then normal people on the phone. Oh, come on, I kid. I'm joking. You're all normal. You can call us at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I will also take your IMs. See you on the better half.